Well, we might as well start. I feel a little guilty bringing people in from the sunshine this afternoon, but I think we might have some interesting exchange on this topic this afternoon at any rate. My name is Jody Kretzmann, and this is a session that I've called Why Blame the Media. It's a session that came to mind to do about halfway through the week, when I had gone to about four sessions in a row that various people on the teaching faculty had done on the city, on racism, on Central America. What was the other one? I think on feminism as well, where in every session, at some point, someone began talking about the inadequacy of information flow through the mass media. And the problem being discussed got transformed from whatever the problem was that was being defined, whether the economy of cities or racism or whatever, into a discussion about the media. And I thought, well, that's interesting. And I also thought, well, that happens almost all the time. And therefore, it might be interesting just to do some exchange on the question of the media and what I sometimes call media bashing. Media bashing is a popular sport, it seems to me, these days. And as a former journalist, sometimes I get just a little defensive about the popularity of that sport of media bashing, as anybody who's ever done a job. I must hasten to add that I quit journalism a long time ago, so I don't think I have any particular immediate axes to grind about it, but it is in my blood a little bit, and I think that my major goal is to make all of us, myself included, and it takes some discipline, into more intelligent critics of the media. It is in the mass media, the growth of the mass media are just incredible, is incredible, over the last 40 years in particular. Any measure you can take will talk about in various ways the decrease of the amount of information that we get from each other face to face, and the increase of the amount of information that we get that is not meant directly for us. That is, it has a mass quality about it. It is mass media. It is aimed at a demographic group somehow that we get defined into, and it continues to grow. It is what it's why Dan Erlender in his Bible study the other morning could talk about voices in the air. Voices in the air. He was talking about it as sort of demonic voices in the air. And everybody sort of nodded. That didn't seem like entirely a spooky idea. It didn't seem like something out of the Middle Ages or somebody who'd not gotten over the last Halloween party. It sounded like he was talking about voices in the air being mass media, which is in fact literally true. We need to understand them better than we do right now. So I would really like to build us into more intelligent media bashers. As a journalist, so you know, I haven't worked for a big city daily. Most of my experience was with Time Magazine and Life Magazine, where the deadlines come weekly and not daily, and that changes the ballgame a little bit. I have written some stuff that has been in daily papers, and I certainly know a lot of people who work for daily papers, so I think I have a sort of sense of that. And I also have a lot of contacts and have some experience in working with the electronic media, both radio and television, and each of them have different kinds of effects. So let me say just a few simple things for about 10 or 15 minutes, and then let's open it up to some exchange, because there's a sense certainly in which we're all experts in this area. Let's be clear that I want to focus anyway on the news media and not the media of mass entertainment. They are distinguishable. I'm interested just in this afternoon, if we can, although we can get off in discussion on the media of mass entertainment if you want to. I'm interested in how the world, the real world as lived, comes to us via the media. All right. The simple diagram is simply that someplace all around us every day, a whole bunch of stuff called real-world life happens, right? We partake in only a small bit of that, one little corner of that real-world life. We need for various reasons, or want for various reasons, to know more about it than our little corner can tell us. And the only way we know that these days is by the mediation the interpretation of the media, what we generally call the media. And here we are in our totally other role as a public who consumes information. We act in a real world that we know. We consume information in some other kind of world, a world that has been mediated for us. There are two kinds of important questions, it seems to me, that you can ask, two sort of categories of questions about this very simple scheme about the media. One question centers here, and it has to do with the relationship between the real world and the media. That is, how is life in the real world? How is life in the real world understood, interpreted, molded, and communicated by the media? That is, the first set of questions focuses right here on our little continuum. It focuses on the relationship between these institutions, the institutions of the mass media, and real life. Okay? That's one whole set of questions. There's a whole other set of questions that I think are equally interesting that focuses over here, number two, the relationship between the media and the public, this time seen as consumers of information. So this set of questions involves asking things like, how does the information-consuming public interact with mass media? All right. What effects do media have on our feelings, even, let alone our understandings of the real world? Let me suggest that we're just beginning to explore these second sets of questions. We don't really know what it means that we have such a small realm of activity in our real life, yet we know so much that's been mediated about the world around us. We just don't know what that means for human community. This is sort of where the outer boundaries of media research are, I think, at this point, sort of sociology of media, almost philosophy, okay? Questions of meaning. This is one, the first area of questions is an area that we know more about. And because we know more about it, I want to say a few more things about that. We may want to say more or speculate more in this last area. Let me just reiterate that I think these first sets of questions, the questions that ask how do mass media understand, select from, and interpret the real world, are important to ask for us to make us more critical consumers. If we know how the media operate and how they interpret the real world and how they choose what they're going to tell us and how they package it, we can read between the lines constantly. And when we do media bashing, we can be better at it. Three critical questions that I want to review very quickly at the beginning, remembering that we're dealing with the news media. I want to think with you very briefly about how news, out of all of the things that happen in the real world, how news is defined, how news gets gathered, and how news gets reported. What are the rules that define how news gets defined, gathered, and reported? And secondly, just to lead us in a short exercise that asks, how do we use that knowledge about how news gets defined, gathered, and reported to read the papers, to make ourselves, in fact, and concretely, better media bashers? I think there are a lot of problems thinking about the real world as news. And if you've worked in news, do we have any other people, any other journalists in the audience here that can talk about this a little bit? Great. Thinking about the real world as news is a restrictive way of thinking about the real world. It is a set of particular blinders, just like scientists have particular blinders, or cooks have particular blinders, or theologians have particular blinders. Certainly news people, media reporters, have particular blinders. Understanding the nature of the blinders is important. What's news? The parts of the world that get defined as news have at least these kinds of characteristics. One, obviously, news is new. It's supposed to be new. Think of all the things in real life that aren't.
Think of all the important things in real life that are not new, that have not been appearing on the horizon just since 9 o'clock this morning. Think of all the things in real life that defining what is important by what is new leaves out. Think about the way in which defining important events as new events leaves out the possibility of understanding the world as continuous. Think about how the requirement to be new is also the requirement to be disconnected from the previous. In fact, if a thing is new, it is not old. If a thing is new, it is not connected. It's not history. It's not a part of history. Thinking about the world as only new things piled up one after the other is a very odd way of thinking about the world. Number two, mostly the only parts of the world that get defined as the real world that get defined as new are events. Think of all of life that you know that is not an event. Have you ever been on the side of the news operation, the news process, where you're trying to influence a medium, a news medium, to take your story, to report something it is that you're doing or that you think is important? You know that in order to get the news media to cover your story, you need to stage an event. As a matter of fact, there is a whole new profession, really, of people who are expert basically in staging events that can then be defined by the news media as news. Right? Political campaigns, for instance, are basically organized around news events these days. And there are professional manipulators of media whose sole area of expertise is on the creation of those kinds of events. They don't do that necessarily because that's the best way to run that they want to run a political campaign that way. They do it because the media sees the world as events. Again, the world, it doesn't come as continuous and connected development of the growth of poverty in a city. The world comes when that story gets told. That story gets told because of an event, because of a riot. It's the riots that get reported, not the continuing story about real life growth of poverty in cities. So what's news is new, and what's news is events. And let me suggest, finally, the third characteristic of what's news is that news has to fit into already existing formulae. That is, that at any given time, I think, if you look at the ideology of the media of mass communication, you see at work a certain number of explanatory formulas. Formulas that are so much a part of the mainstream way of interpreting events that they don't even have to be repeated. What formulas do, the existence of formulas for explaining events, what that does is to knock out the necessity for news people to interpret what it is they're reporting. You start thinking about what examples of formulas that are just assumed as background for the reporting of news. I think you can come up with some. I thought about it for a little while. These are the accepted interpretations. All media of mass communication in the United States, accept the formulaic interpretation of international events as an East-West conflict. That's the Soviet Union and the U.S. and the United States of America. That is a formula that is embedded deeply into the understanding of the world that filters the news, filters the events. That's not questioned. Events that don't fit easily into USSR-US conflict don't get reported, particularly out of Washington, D.C. there are other sorts of formulas that are not so political. Any time a story, there's sort of, some of them have sort of mythical qualities. The story of individual heroism is a story that news people know just by doing it over and over again. It is one that is going to connect with the public. It's one that is going to somehow tug at the heartstrings, and it is one that is therefore sought out. And any time you've got any kind of event in the real world, out of the zillions of events in the real world, that can, by the longest stretch of the imagination, be fit into the formula of individual heroism, it will be in the newspaper. That is an instance, it seems to me, of a formula that pre-exists the news stories. It's sort of like you've got a blank hole on a news page that's always capable of being filled up with that particular formula story. Right?
Question: how would a cultural exchange between USSR and US fit in? Would that be a formula, or would that be a?
Well, I think that that's a story insofar as it is about, right, the formula that says what's important in international affairs is the relationship between the USSR and the U.S. I think we could think of examples of stories that get badly reported and distorted, Central America being one, because of that formula about all international events having to be read in an East-West context. North-South context, for instance, gets short shrift, right? The individual historical dynamics of countries in the Southern Hemisphere tend not to be reported in the U.S. press because it doesn't fit a formula they've got. You can think of other kinds of formulas. It seems to me there are various kinds of formulas that define how newspapers report crime story. Crime is an interesting set of stories to think about, because it is an instance of the formulas getting defined by the dominant institutions in a field. I'll get to that one in just a minute. But for instance, crime as event, always gets interpreted from the police point of view. There are reasons for that in terms of how the news operates and how reporters operate. But crime is an interesting area simply because the dominant institutions in the area of criminal justice have managed the definition of what happens. And if any of you have ever lived in inner city areas and know kids and so on that are involved in stuff, you know that there are lots of other interpretations of what it is that's going on in the streets. So those three things I think are interesting just to sort of play with and think about as ways of thinking about how only parts of the real world get defined as news. News has to be new, it has to be an event, and it has to fit into some sort of received formula. You could probably think of some others. Second question, how is the news gathered? This is also, I think, a way of understanding how what news is gets limited. I want to just talk about a couple of things under the category of how news gets gathered. The main thing I want to talk about is the beat system. You all know about the beat system. Most newspapers work on the beat system, and most both print and electronic media work on the beat system. That is, a reporter gets assigned a certain area. The area could be defined by a set of institutions, the police beat, the courts beat, the White House, the Pentagon, and so on, or it could be defined by an issue area, right? You cover crime, you cover cities if you're a national correspondent, you cover whatever. The beat system is interesting to think about because it is also a way that strongly filters what it is we get. I just started to make a couple of lists of the advantages and disadvantages of a beat system that I could think of. When I think about what the advantages are, one clearly is that a reporter who has, mostly is not an expert on anything. I mean, in the academic sense, he's not an expert on anything. If you have a beat system and a reporter is going to stay on it for a year or two or three, there's a good chance that she or he will actually know something about what they're writing about, at least after a year or two. And that's something of an advantage. When you live in a city, I particularly see this in TV reporters. We certainly get an awful lot of people in Chicago who are absolute airheads in terms of their knowledge of the city of Chicago. You know, they just they don't have the slightest idea where they are. They're on their way through from a slightly smaller market toward the networks, and one stop is Chicago. I think electronic media in general attracts the kind of airhead journalists. But even in electronic media, it's clear to me that when somebody stays on a beat, whether it's a city hall beat or a police beat or whatever, for a year or two, they know something. So that's an advantage. It's also true that when you've got a beat system, within the definition of that beat, the newspaper or the radio station or the TV station is less likely to miss something important if it falls within the category of that beat, right? Because simply because it's logical, because the reporter's going to be there all the time. A big crime story or a big politics story is not going to get by any of the newspapers in Chicago because they've got people hanging out at City Hall, hanging out at the police station and so on. But I can also think of some disadvantages, and you can probably add to this list too. And one or two of these I've experienced myself. For one thing, if you think about yourself as a reporter on a beat, one of the things you know is that whatever you write today, you're going to have to be talking to the same people tomorrow. Right? You cannot afford to offend your sources. If you're a police reporter and you get your major information from the roster of crimes at the district station or downtown or major station or wherever, you're a city hall reporter, you know that whatever you write this afternoon, you're going to have to meet the same people and talk to them tomorrow. And you're going to want another story tomorrow. So the beat system in and of itself, it seems to me, is a conservatizing influence. It ties in an identity of interests between the reporter and the institution being covered. It diminishes the journalistic independence of the reporter. Right? It also, and I think we can go back to the crime area here, it seems to me, it tends to restrict the view of the world that the journalist gets to the view of the institution that the journalist covers. To me, that's most evident continually in the police story. But it's also clear when you watch national news. You know, there are reporters assigned continually to the Pentagon. The Kalb brothers at CBS, between them, have been shuttling between the Pentagon and the State Department for about 30 years. Well, as any of you who are tied to institutions, even churches or seminaries, know that when you're in an institution that long, you begin to sound like that institution. You begin to adapt its values, its norms, its view of the world. So it wasn't any particular surprise to us that, for instance, one of the Kalb brothers just up and left CBS about 6 or 8 years ago and is now the spokesperson for the Pentagon. There's not that much difference between those two roles after a while. When there's a little bit of independence, just thinking about the national reporting scene and the electronic media that we're acquainted with, when there's a little bit of independence on the part of somebody who's got, for instance, the White House beat, Sam Donaldson at ABC at this point seems to be the major sort of thorn in Reagan's side. And if you watch Donaldson's work from week to week, it's clear that he doesn't deviate very much from what the White House press office is telling him. He occasionally asks questions of congressional sources. That's all he does. But that's enough to get the White House continually peeved. So the major point, once again, is that the beat system tends to restrict the view of the world and define it, on the part of the journalist, to the view of the world of the institution being covered. Just one more comment on another kind of restriction that we might talk about some more. Anybody who has ever worked with TV news knows that the view of the world of TV news people is even further restricted by the constant pressure for what they call good visuals. Right? If a story does not have good visuals, that is, if there's not something exciting to see, to film, it is not a story. It is not a story. And there certainly are zillions of parts of the real world that are not immediately amenable to exciting visuals. I think we could spend a whole another couple of hours thinking about ways in which TV distorts the real world because of its need for visualizing the real world. Anybody who writes for TV news will share after a while their frustrations at the diminution of the written word and its importance, and the dominance of the visual kind of a view of the world. I worked for a while for Life magazine, and I felt some of that. I was a writer in a photographer's medium. And I felt some of that after a while too. Life was a place that was defined by photographic needs, by visual needs. And, you know, telling a story through words is not something that that gets a high priority there. And it's certainly more that way in TV news. Okay, so I've talked briefly, I hope, about what is news and how is news gathered. The last thing, real briefly, I want to say is a couple of words about how is news reported. Right? Once it's chosen and gathered, then it has to be framed and reported in some way. As those of you who've ever had a journalism course know, most of the time still, news is reported in a very strictly defined and I think very confining format. That format is called the inverted pyramid. Right? Have you all heard of the inverted pyramid? Just like that. And that's what you learn in journalism school. More and more journalists these days come out with masters and from journalism schools. And that is the biblical center of the journalism curriculum. Have you been through journalism school?
Not journalism school. I'm a senior at
MBA. I think you'll probably still find it true that the major sort of formal way of thinking about once you've chosen the news, once you've gathered the news, how you report the news, is the inverted pyramid. So that the most important facts have to be listed at the top, who, what, when, where, and why, and they have to be listed first. And all other, particularly background and interpretive information, is regarded as absolutely secondary. And when an editor of any kind who gets the reporter's stuff begins to try to fit it into a newspaper, the editor always wants to be able to cut from the bottom up, right? You always write a little bit long and then the editor cuts. And the perfectly laudable intention, the laudable intention of the inverted pyramid is that the important stuff, the most important facts of the story, no matter what you cut out of it, will still be there. If you leave the top paragraph, the top two paragraphs, the top three paragraphs, the reader will know that, even if the story has been four-fifths cut by your city editor. Flotsam and jetsam of life, right? It's not important stuff. Now, I'm talking about news stories here, and there are a lot more interpretive stories going on these days. One other point about how news is reported. When there's interpretation, the formula, the restrictive, let me argue again, the restrictive formula which is applied to reporters is that you must get comments from leading participants, and if there's anything controversial, leading participants from two sides, right? And the way you do evaluative journalism is you have one side say something about whatever the story is, and if there's another side, you have the other experts say something about what the story is. That is the formula for interpreting events, for evaluating what has happened. And if you think about that for a while, if you think about that for a while in the framework of its restrictiveness, if something important has happened and what you need to do is to get one sentence from a person who thinks this way about it and one sentence from a person who thinks that way about it, and that's the interpretation of the event that you will be allowed to put in your news story, you can begin to think about how limited the interpretive possibilities are for most news stories. There are lots more we could say about the limitations.
Johnny?
Yeah?
Can I just share what I've been at?
Absolutely.
I've been in college for 3 years now, and the first year I had an old school professor who taught inverted pyramid. These last 2 years, I had a younger professor. She's just been a teaching profession for and so her influence has worn off on another professor. So our philosophy has been now, as far as I can see, that a story should have a very strong ending, or a very strong beginning with, of course, the pertinent information, an equally strong end, and then everything so that it's a complete unit, so that, and this is possible with the evolution of electronic media.
You could fit it better.
Mm-hmm. Being able to put it on a computer, fit it, being able to tell exactly how many inches that story will be so that it will be a complete unit. And it won't be cut up by an editor who did not write the story and does not know the background that the reporter does.
I think that's right. That's an excellent point. I think the whole turnover of newspapers to electronic production systems and computer production systems has really changed things a lot. Thank you for that.
I hope that
that's
will
right.
help a lot in clarifying stories.
Let me just say one last thing. I was sort of thinking about what I think the overall effect of all this is. I still think that if you think about what the view of the world that you get from the press, and because of what journals do, we get this view. I think you get a view of the world that is largely made up of disconnected events, events which are both independent of each other, right, and that are detached from any history. They are basically, I think, often, too often, events, therefore, that don't mean anything. They certainly don't add up to an even sort of semi-coherent whole. And I think then finally, because they don't mean anything and because they're disconnected from history, that they may be events that by the nature of their definition cannot be affected by citizens. So I guess that's my one foray into what we could talk about for hours, which is the second set of questions. What's the effect on the consumers of information. I have a concern about the way in which the real world gets interpreted through media, which is centered on the denuding of the possibility of citizenship, of public action, of our even thinking about ourselves as public actors, and a sort of creation more and more of a private space where we are effective actors, maybe in family and with personal relationships, and as consumers of information, but a shrinking, as Newhouse and others have talked about it, a shrinking of the public square, a shrinking of our capacity to affect events. And that's not unconnected to how the events come to us. That's my real worry, I guess, as a citizen. Finally, I won't do it right now, but let me just suggest that when you read papers, I did bring a couple papers over here, I always find it helpful with my students when I'm trying to get them to be critical consumers of the media, to go through an exercise with a newspaper that asks one simple question about each story. And that is the question, what did the journalist do? Not what's the story about, right? There are two ways to look at these stories. The story may be about something, but the story is also, read between the lines, the report of what a human being did in her or his role as a reporter. And one way of reading between the lines is to recognize what it is that a reporter did. That will usually point up, for instance, the fact that what a reporter did was sit at her desk or his desk and get a news release, right? Or maybe go over and interview the head of the department, which is her or his beat. Police chief or something. Or maybe just take something off the AP or UPI wire and redo it a little bit. Knowing what the reporter actually did to get the story is one way of sort of demystifying the news. Right? It's one way of saying, look, this is just a human being with a very restricted view of the real world doing her or his job to the best of her or his ability. Once we know that, we can be critical but even forgiving media bashers. Let me stop there and see if we can get into some talk about your own experience with the media, critiques of it, and how you see it.
I'd like to go back to the formula, maybe follow through a little bit, but the formula for good news. I think that one of the criticisms of the media is never or so seldom good news. But if possibly following it through and then going back to number two is what is important to the public. is good news important to the public, or when the criticism comes, is it from really people that were part of the good news, but no one else cares? And I'm asking, I really don't know.
What do other people think about that? That's certainly one of the critiques that comes up. Why is news mostly bad news?
Self-copy.
Why, though? What would you think?
Probably likes to know what's going on. If it's gory or bad accident, did you read about it?
But I wonder if we also buy it if we got some good news. That is the most common complaint that I hear, is that we hear everything bad and there's got to be good happening in the world. Has anybody tried it out to see if we would buy it for good news? Well, that's a pretty pessimistic point of view. I don't agree with that.
Well, I think going back to the premise, though, of what makes news, and if news, it has to be number one, news, and number two, an event, our world is pretty filled with events that are not terribly good news, and that's unfortunate, but that's a realistic picture of if we're following what the two guidelines have to be for news media. Now there's another whole area of news that's human interest stories and things like that that can bring in happier news. And you find that usually in your Sunday paper that you'll have one section that seems to carry the nicer things of life. But on a day-to-day basis, the majority of the news is going to be events that are occurring, and it's things like Central America and Lebanon and South Africa, et cetera, and those aren't particularly good news.
Well, it's possible to think that, in fact, most of life is good. And that the exceptional stuff and the new stuff, the new, is what is exceptional, is what is bad. I mean, maybe.
There's also a lot of...
I think the disconnection of the event from the history of the what led up to the event is probably what's most frustrating for most people who want to learn more from the news. And it's always seemed to me that the thing that's alarming about it is it seems to me that even big name reporters in places like Lebanon, South Africa, Central America probably don't have a sense for that. Do you think they do? I don't think that they really sat down with them, that they could really interpret what a major event in South Africa, say in Lebanon, how that tied in with the whole historical background in the Middle East. I don't think they have a sense for that themselves.
I think there's really some variation among people. I mean, I have a friend who spent a lot of time in the Middle East as a journalist, as a reporter for the New York Times, who I see occasionally. He certainly is a scholar of Middle East conflicts, and you can read it in his stories, but not every one of his stories. But the Times is a place, you know, that still gives their people enough inches to do interpretation, and it's very unusual in that way. Circumstances often hamper the collection of news in foreign countries. It's certainly true that most of the journalists in Vietnam, and now I think most of them in Central America, never get out of the hotel where the foreign journalists are, you know? And what we get is rumor, and we get statements by a variety of government authorities, but we don't get very much. It's very exceptional, and you really have to go to alternative media, I think, mainly, to get good interpretive and reporting stuff that's based on something that's not at the hotel bar in a lot of foreign settings, particularly in war settings. Ingrid?
Well, there's just a lot of, you were saying earlier that the background maybe is good and the exceptions are the news. But I think the background is often bad, but not reported. For example, the condition of poor people in my city is not known. It's not news. It's not news how the thousands and thousands and thousands of people who live in public housing projects live. It's not known, or it's not news that more than half of the people who graduate from high school in Chicago can't read and write, you know, or that more than half of the people who enter school in Chicago don't graduate high school, they drop out. along the way. You know, all that isn't news, but that's our background. That's deep background, and it's not, you know, what would we would have an event one day where we would get all those people who dropped out of high school or were pushed out to come to a rally and be counted, maybe, then it would be news, you know. How can people be aware of what the sort of deep background is of my city, even the people who live in my city? But instead they just blame a kid who knifes somebody when he's robbing her because he needs the money because he can't get a job because he doesn't have an education and he can't read and he's got a record, you know. I mean, I just think there's so much about the news that's just not new. I mean, so much about what really is going on, it's just totally lost from view.
But isn't that more the fault of the consumer who doesn't really want to know those things many times? I mean, the media will also see things from the position of, this is our business, we give people what they want, I think. I mean,
maybe we get the owners and what they want. The owners.
Well, it's also true, I think, that I mean, I think one of the things, Ingrid, that you're pointing to is that reality is so much more rich and complex and that you can't contain it in a 16-inch news story. I mean, no matter what the news story is about, you're not going to be able to figure out what the sort of underlying richness of the context is in that kind of a format. Here.
Many people say that Americans are so much more poorly informed than people in other countries. I certainly think that there's a dearth of foreign news in our average daily, but why is that?
Yeah, I was going to make a comment on that.
Okay.
I had a chance to travel to Singapore a lot, and I was amazed when I started reading foreign newspapers and how interesting they were, and all these things that we never hear about. And I even debated taking the Singapore newspaper just so I could find out about the rest of the world. I didn't do that. But I think it probably relates back to what you're saying, that, you know, it's more east-west. You know, if it isn't east-west, it probably doesn't get in. And to these people in other countries, though, we're like a giant elephant walking around. And, you know, and they're a little country, and then they watch all these other places. And I think we're not that interested in what they're doing.
That's right.
Yeah, I think the formulas are less restrictive almost any place in the Western world than they are in the United States, particularly the East-West. I think that's absolutely right.
Is it our chauvinism, our arrogance, that we're interested only in ourselves, or what's the problem?
Well, I think other journalists in other countries can be interested in themselves, but if they don't have the burden of understanding the world in such a narrow framework, then they can tell the story as it is. I mean, we can actually get into some of the unique and rich histories of African nations and therefore understand those conflicts, the same with Central America and so forth, and we don't have to necessarily read all that through the incredibly narrow tunnel vision that we've got here to read all that. Sure. And that's partly what you're experiencing, like foreign press.
I don't sort of buy the argument about that's what people want, because given the chance to buy a crummy newspaper and an own newspaper, I'll buy a crummy, you know, just so I can at least get an idea. In fact, I'll even buy one in a country where the press is controlled.
Between a crummy newspaper and no newspaper, you're saying?
Right, yeah. And I, you know, there's, like in Tucson, there's two papers. They're both the same, the evening and the morning. Evening paper and morning paper are owned by this big publishing company, Gannett,
yeah.
And they've gone around the United States buying up all these papers, and they're giving us what they want to give us. And, you know, I don't mean to sound paranoid, but it's not a very good paper, but I get it because at least it's something. But it's not what I want. So to say that crummy newspapers sell is only part of, you know,
sure. I mean, there's a whole other, you're just touching on yet another issue we could spend another hour on, which is the growing concentration of ownership of the media. That's really accelerated in the last 20 years. Gannett is one example, but an awful lot of towns now have newspapers that are not locally owned, and that makes a big difference, I think.
Do you have a theory on how our formula became so restrictive?
Well, I think that the United States, I mean, my own general feeling is that, well, that's a really complicated question. I mean, it has to do with the whole development of anti-communism, it seems to me, as a sort of central ideological tenet of the American culture in the last 25 or 30 years. I mean, my own view is that, you know, American politics spans the entire spectrum from A to B and nowhere near Z. And if that's our spectrum of political thought, A to B, which it basically is, and the whole world is A to Z in a spectrum of political thought, we just don't have the interpretive framework for understanding the rest of the world. There's a lot of reasons for that. That's a whole course of the history of anti-communism since World War II in the United States. But I do think that the media have generally accepted that view of the world. We've had, you know, points in the last 30 or 40 years where it's loosened up a little bit. And if you look at the media during those periods, you can see the loosening in times of the thaws between USSR and the United States. You can see the loosening reflected in the way the media report things. But we're certainly back now to a highly frozen state of Cold War kind of thinking, and the media reflect that.
Along with all our criticism, though, we should occasionally stop and be very thankful for the freedom of press and freedom of information that we really do have in this country. It might not be the balance we like, but last year we went to Russia, and I had a long conversation with a young Russian boy on the street in Kiev, and he just told me straight out it doesn't do him any good to read the paper, because he, to quote him, he says, "I said the same old stuff for the last 10 years. We don't know anything that's going on in the world."
Well,
so, you know,
yeah.
We've got it a lot better here, and we should be grateful for that, even though we'd like to change some of it.
Yeah, the basic approach of trying to be critical consumers of the media, though, is exactly what our Sovietologists, our experts on the Soviet Union, do in trying to figure out what's going on in the Soviet Union. I mean, they pour over the pages of Pravda and Izvestia very carefully, line by line, knowing who the journalists are, knowing what the dynamics are, knowing what the journalists did that day, right, mm-hmm. and where the decisions came from, to try to figure out what's actually going on. I think I'm suggesting that a similar process is necessary in the United States to read the press, too. You can't figure out a lot, I think, from the Soviet press.
I was going to ask, because advertising and public relations is my background, do you think that economics is playing a big part in the way news is handled today, and the time factor also, because there's such demanding deadlines, particularly if you're working with a newspaper or radio or TV, and it's, you don't have the luxury of years ago of a weekly or whatever. And then the economics, I know that, you know, that was constantly what we were hearing is, you know, you got to have more ad space, and the newspapers are ending up with less news columns and more ad space. And when that happens, you just have to give less and less news. And I see that as really part of, for me anyway, it seems to be a big problem, the economics.
It's always a conflict, I think. If you talk to journalists, at least my experience is that the economics of the business is felt more by journalists in the electronic media than in the print media, because the electronic media really do live by the ratings books, you know. And when the ratings books come out, that determines whether that station is going to have the ad revenue to keep the staff on, or whether they're going to have to fire somebody, right? So the electronic media journalists really are concerned about ratings, which certainly is another way that constricts their view of what it is they do. It's not as clear to me that print media people, that is, news people in the print media, think much about the business all the time. I mean, there is some inbuilt institutional tension always between the business end of a paper and the news end of a paper, but for the most part, they're two operationally, they're two separate operations, and the news department gets a news hole to fill, and there's some, you know, talk about whether that's too big or too little every day, but otherwise I don't think news people are directly constrained by the economics of their operation. A lot of indirect constraints, it seems to me.
I have one question that's to do with the art of writing in a column. So many writers in writing about a person will go on for about two paragraphs before they mention the person's name, and finally when I discovered who it is, I have to go back to the beginning and read what he said about him.
Hmm.
Why do they think that that's such great writing? That's very common.
Do you have any example in columns you're talking about?
I'm
not in news?
I'm talking about a column in a magazine or a newspaper. I'll go on and on and say, I'll talk about this person. Finally, they come to his name.
Well, you've obviously, as a consumer of that particular written piece of material, got a disagreement with the writer about what a good lead is.
A good lead ought to sort of seduce you into the story.
It's a popular method of writing. It's a formula, I'd say.
Yeah.
I'd like to know who they're talking about first, but maybe that's because I've got a juvenile mind or something.
Yeah, yeah. Well, I doubt that. But I do think there's such a thing as fads in journalism, like in any other kind of a profession, and that certain journalists from year to year are hot on the national scene, and therefore you'll find all kinds of other people copying their styles. I don't know. I can't immediately put that particular quirk together with some person.
As
but
promoted as being a great way of writing or what?
Well, I don't think so. I don't think so.
Two comments on news out of Washington that is often, that's so often attributed to sources who refuse to be identified. isn't the press prostituting itself by printing the stuff that, you know, from anonymous sources?
I think often that's true. But often there are good reasons to. I mean, often the choice that a particular reporter has is to be able to print something, but not attribute it, or print nothing at all. And I guess given that choice, most people would say, well, let's print it and attribute it to an unnamed source. That practice has all kinds of problems with it, though, and it's just the more that happens, the more you see that happening, it's a commentary on the information policy of a particular bureaucracy or a particular administration or whatever. And I think we are seeing it a lot these days, and I don't think we're seeing, and I don't think, Larry Speak seems to be a very nice guy, but he does not run a very open White House press operation. I mean, the Reagan White House is pretty tight, pretty tightly closed up to journalists. So if they're going to get people to talk to them at all, they're going to get people to talk to them off the record.
Another question I had, some of this came about because of some of the discussions on Central America the other night, and I think somebody raised the question, why don't we hear more about? And I'm not sure we ever got that answered. Do you have any feelings about why we don't hear? We had, it seems, for a time, some good investigative reporting on different issues in the world, everything from Watergate to Vietnam, that really finally got the people aware of what was happening, but we don't seem to have that. Is it, again, because of the East-West thing, and that's not East-West?
I think that's partly it. I think that what's news there doesn't get determined very much by what happens there. It gets determined by what happens in Washington, so that when there's a crucial vote, for instance, on Capitol Hill, that area of the world will get defined once again as news. I mean, that's a sort of, it seems to me that's a subtle sort of journalistic imperialism, right? That events in those countries in and of themselves won't get reported as news. I mean, in all of these areas, it seems to me that there are alternative news sources available, and you don't have to go overseas for them, but you really do have to look at the small journals. The small journals of opinion, the small journals of reporting, to get very good stuff from a lot of areas of the world.
So the consumer has to be wiser.
I think so. I mean, the two things you can do, it seems to me, is to learn how to read between the lines of the mass media, and in lots of cases, make an end run around them.
Secondary.
Read something else.
It's been said that our age is one that is not interested in history anymore, and that we really have a problem understanding the world because we want to see what happened before. Do you think that has something to do with the fact that we don't want to interpret events from a historical point of view?
Sure. I mean, it seems, I don't know what's causing it, what's effect there, but it's certainly a related set of observations, right? I mean, again, news is an ahistorical concept, right? It's a detached kind of concept. I mean, you know, it is amazing how many people don't know who Sandino is. We were talking about the other night, and yet try to make some intelligent decisions about what to do with Sandinistas.
I think this is why your title is the media to blame. I don't think they are. I think the consumer is to blame for not realizing that there's a limitation to what TV or the newspaper can present. But we're so taken up with instant information, instant news. And we get a little impatient, and it's not given to us completely, and we can digest it instantly. Mm-hmm. And we don't make that end run to read some of the journal, sit down and read a book about a country and get some historical background. And I think the media does an exceptional job within their limitations, but we as consumers are doing a horrible job